There are truly mixed feelings about the return of gray wolves to parts of the West. There is joy about the reappearance of a species that had been hunted to nothing in the region when our grandparents were young. But there is also apprehension, especially for people who own livestock. They worry, with some evidence, that wolves develop a taste for a relatively easy meal from farm or ranch. Wildlife managers in eastern Oregon recently killed some wolves to end attacks on livestock, but they hasten to add that killing a wolf is an absolute last resort. Let's hear where the earlier resorts are, because there's lots of work in developing those. Two guests with us. Julie Young is with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She is with the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS, also attached to the National Wildlife Research Center. Dr. Young, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Derek Broman is with us as well. He is with the State Oregon Fish and Wildlife, and he's the Carnivore Fur Bearer Coordination. Hi, Derek.
Good morning.
Sounds like a very broad area of responsibility you've got there. What does it involve?
I manage the bear, cougar, and wolf programs in addition to the fur bearer program, which entails game and non-game fur bearers, so bobcats, beaver, lynx, wolverine, and kit fox, all of those small furry critters.
I did want to ask you about cougars. That is in your domain, because there was a recent, there had to be a takeout in Klamath County. Is that right?
I'm not abreast of that situation, but certainly, yes, there's instances, incidents that are dealt with on a pretty regular basis, animals coming and encroaching on urban areas, which is kind of a new frontier of cougar management here in Oregon.
Are the incidents growing in number because of the fact that people want to live in the woods?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. It's people expanding, but also cougars expanding, especially in northwest Oregon. We're seeing more cougars show up in the greater Portland metroplex, which is indicative of actually the cougars expanding into that area. So it's some situations, it's a combination of both.
Okay, Julie Young, let's bring you in here. Tell us a bit what APHIS is about. Is the aim generally to protect livestock?
Well, yes. Yeah, so within APHIS, there's a lot of different things, but I work directly underneath that in Wildlife Services, National Wildlife Research Center, and our mission is to reduce human-wildlife conflict, and so that does include livestock depredation and conflict in urban areas, and then also conflict with threatened and endangered species.
So in general, has your caseload come up a bit in recent years, given it seems like there are more conflicts of humans and animals?
Yeah, so I'm a researcher, so my caseload hasn't changed, but the demand for what we're finding out has. And so that's always a good thing, that people are a little bit more interested in learning what the science is saying behind conflict.
Was the science something that had lain fallow for a long time, Julie, because of the fact that, I mean, there were no wolves to guard against for decades?
Well, in a way, yes, and in a way, no. We still had a lot of cougars on the landscape, a lot of coyotes on the landscape, which are still the number one predator of sheep, at least, in all of America. And so we've always, and then there's still a lot of black bears, and grizzly bears are also recovering. So we've always been dealing with these issues. What's different is where the conflicts are happening and what species are involved.
So are the same sorts of things that would work for a coyote not necessarily the same kinds of things that would keep a wolf at bay?
Actually, a lot of them are pretty similar, and you know, we're finding a little bit of differences. Some people are saying that some of the tools that we've given them aren't working or aren't as effective, but a lot of times that's just modifying the tool and not necessarily creating new ones. And so a lot of times it does work. In fact, a lot of times they work better against wolves because wolves are more susceptible to disturbance than coyotes. Coyotes will just kind of keep coming back and trying new things, whereas if you can really threaten or make a wolf feel intimidated, a lot of times the techniques will last longer against them.
Interesting. So a wolf will learn it the first time, and the coyote will just think, yeah, fine, that's great, I'm coming back again.
Yeah, they both learn, but I guess they learn different lessons.
Right. Derek Broman, give us an idea of the kinds of research that goes on within your area or within ODFW generally. I mean, do you rely on APHIS and National Wildlife Research Center to bring stuff to you, or is there separate research going on at the same time?
Similar to the previous question, the answer is both. We are actively looking at information that is collected anywhere on the subject matter. And because wolves have really only been in the state for the past decade, we don't have a whole lot of our own data to lean on, especially some historical information. So we'll lean on the publications and the products that come out of groups such as Julie's Camp. But also we are engaged in wolf research in Oregon, but primarily in northeastern Oregon, where right now we've got a study looking at interactions between a suite of large carnivores and elk as well. So we will continue to try and conduct research where we see that the need is there, and apply our own findings, but we're always going to have our ear to the ground to try to see what's being learned in other areas and try to apply that to be efficient and see results.
Derek Broman is with Oregon Fish and Wildlife, where he's the Carnivore Fur Bearer Coordinator. Dr. Julie Young is with the National Wildlife Research Center through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And we're talking about keeping the wolves at bay without killing them here in the exchange. 800-838-3760 if you want to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Derek, I want to come back to what you just mentioned, though, about studies of carnivores and elk. Are elk depredations increasing in, where there are more wolves now?
Well, we know that elk are the primary prey of wolves, and we've got that evidence here in Oregon. However, a number of our elk populations seem to be doing quite well in those areas of overlap. And we're updating our wolf plan right now, and that was actually a big section of interest to put into that plan, of trying to describe what is the response to a number of our ungulate populations to the increase of wolves. So right now, it seems that things are all right, but as we know, it's never clearly black and white and a simple relationship between predators and prey. There's always other things at hand.
So much has been said over the years about the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone National Park and how that's changed the landscape because the elk don't just hang out by the streams anymore, for example. So it's resulted in different things noticeable along stream banks, the kind of vegetation that grows there. Have you gotten to that point in Oregon yet where you're noticing any changes in landscape like that?
No, and in Yellowstone, it's a very unmanipulated landscape. It was elk herd populations that were arguably too high, but we don't have that type of situation where we've got a pretty manipulated landscape in areas. So we expect that there's likely some microhabitat changes, but we don't expect that we're going to see anything to that scale just because a national park is so different from the Oregon landscape.
Is wolf management new enough that it feels like the revisions need to come sooner, that you will make revisions to the wolf management plans and stuff on a more regular basis than you might if they'd been here for a long time?
That's a good question. I guess I don't know. Certainly if there's a need and if there's a recognized flaw or gap, we'll address that. Be as progressive and proactive as possible. And updating our wolf plan, it's nice that we're able to kind of omit some of the things that are unapplicable. When the wolf plan was first written, we did not even have wolves on the landscape yet. So there was a lot of guesses or predictions of what may or may not happen. And now we have some information to refine our plan so that it's applicable to what we've experienced and with now the new information that we have available.
So I was talking in the intro about the fact that obviously when ODFW has to take out a wolf, that's what makes the headlines. But, I mean, how long does it usually take to get to that point of decision?
Well, each situation is different, and not every depredation results in a request for a lethal removal. Our plan identifies what type of criteria must take place before even consideration of lethal removal. And so all of that information gets chewed on for a good amount of time by staff and administration to try to determine what is the appropriate response. And certainly the level and type of non-lethals applied and efforts to try and resolve this conflict are weighed pretty heavily.
Julie Young, does the enthusiasm about bringing wolves back to the landscape increase relative to the distance people live from areas where wolves roam?
It's a little bit related to that. We actually studied this a few years ago, and it's also related to time with wolves. So people living closer to Yellowstone that have lived with wolves longer are just more used to it, and it's just part of the landscape and something that they deal with, whereas people in newer areas like eastern Washington and eastern Oregon might still have, and just encountering wolves for the first time, might feel a little bit more threatened by their presence.
I wonder what kind of publicity or outreach goes on in either of your agencies to try to convince people what wolves are and are not capable of. I mean, I know that much has been said over the years about wolves are not the kind that are going to attack a strong member of any herd or generally don't attack humans. What is the truth there, Julie?
Well, we've done a lot of that lately. Our agency partners with local agencies, whether those are extension or universities or nonprofits, and have been putting on a series of non-lethal tools workshops around the country, mostly focused out west in areas with wolves. I think I've spoken at about 25 of them now. In fact, the most recent one was in Medford, Oregon.
I noticed that, a few miles away from us.
Yeah, so we've been doing those, and usually there's somebody there from either, or usually both, the state agency and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, to talk about wolves and wolf population and wolf behavior, and then folks like myself that can talk about some of the non-lethal tools that are available in case ranchers aren't aware of what tools are out there.
So what kind of tools are we talking about? I noticed the term hazing in there. You know, of course, everybody thinks back to college and events there, but let's not go too far down that trail. But you're basically trying to make the wolves uncomfortable, it sounds like.
Yeah, one of the tools that is working pretty well so far and is something that we're actually going to put up in the next month out in Oregon is flaggery. And we call it turbo flaggery because we electrify it. And so it looks like flag football flags. They just hang off the ground a little ways, and it's just a visual scary barrier to canids. And it seems to work really well for wolves, although they will test it sometimes, and that's why we electrify it. And so that would be where the hazing comes in, is that they get zapped, and that reinforces that it was scary and something to be avoided. So that's one of the nice kind of passive tools that ranchers can use in the area if they have a pasture where maybe they're calving or lambing and want to protect that resource during that very critical time when they're most vulnerable to wolf depredation.
So the flags just are a visual, or do they flap in the breeze and make some noise too?
Well, they do flap a little, but it seems that even when they're not flapping, that they keep out wolves and even coyotes to an extent. But they seem to work a lot better and longer against wolves than coyotes, although we're trying to do some research modifying it for coyotes so that it lasts just as long.
We're talking about non-lethal methods to keep wolves at bay as they grow in number around the region. Julie Young is with the federal government out of the National Wildlife Research Center in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Derek Broman is the Carnivore Fur Bearer Coordinator for Oregon Fish and Wildlife, the state agency. You can join the conversation on the exchange. 800-838-3760 over the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. And then, Julie, over time, do you tend to resort to different things? I mean, will the wolves get used to one system, and then you'll need to, a rancher will need to switch over to a different system?
Yes, that's an excellent point. They do learn, and they do habituate. So that's how come, for instance, flaggery we usually leave up for about 90 days during some critical period like calving or lambing, and then encourage ranchers to take it down so it'll be used again in the future. Things like livestock protection dogs are a little bit better in that they actively, in their own way, haze wolves, as you were mentioning earlier, but they provide both an alert system to any shepherd or herder or rancher in the area because they often bark. They may even, not aggressively chase, but move towards the wolf and kind of push them back away. And so they provide something that's a little bit more long-term because they're actively responding. And so the wolves, it's a little less predictable than a flag hanging for the wolves. And so a tool like that actually is used quite readily in that northeastern area of Oregon, and we've even worked with some of the ranchers up there on a research study on them, and we're finding them to be really effective against wolves. I mean, nothing is going to work 100% of the time, but anything that can help reduce risk is great to use.
It sounds like at a minimum you want to make sure that you at least provide some resistance, some challenge to a wolf, that they don't just get the waltz up to where the livestock are kept and help themselves.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of ranchers are already doing that. Some of them might just not be noticing that what they're doing or calling it a non-lethal tool. But anything, even, habitat manipulation where you remove some cover that cougars might hide in, things like that are often just simple things that ranchers can do. And I think a lot of them are doing it for themselves because they don't want to lose their livestock. But there's a lot of other tools out there that people might not be aware of, and they can work with agencies, work with Derek or myself or other people within the community to find out what kind of tools are available and what might work for them and for how long each of these tools work, because they all work differently, and some will work for some people and not for others, and most will work well, but not all the time.
Okay, so yeah, everything has a chance at some point, but not always the same thing. Let's take a call. Here's Ann in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about keeping the wolves at bay with Julie Young and Derek Broman.
Thank you. First a comment and then a question. The comment is, I was in the Wallawas in August, and about 5 miles south of Lostine, I saw a herd at twilight of at least 60 elk. So I don't think the wolves are having an adverse effect on the elk there. Secondly, in northern Minnesota, where they've dealt with wolves forever. They have developed this technique to protect their cattle during calving. And what they do, instead of feeding first thing in the morning, which means the cows are more likely to calve at night, they wait and feed the cattle the last thing in in daylight in the afternoon, and that makes the cows more likely to calve during daylight and less likely to have the wolves as predators. And I was wondering if you knew about that technique. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. Appreciate it. So either Julie or Derek, have you heard of that technique?
Yes, that's a theory is that the cows will not give birth with a full stomach. So, yes, that is a technique that's known, and there's a number of little tricks and ideas that a lot of the ranchers have been proposing on just very mild changes in daily routines to try and see it that reduce the risk during the times of days when they're most vulnerable to wolves.
I was going to ask about that, though, about whether there are other techniques, and it sounds like there are, that people who are on farms and ranches will change some of the rhythm of what they do in addition to trying things that will directly have an effect potentially on the wolves.
Yeah, certainly. One example is just night feeding. When you congregate the cattle together at night, that helps prevent anyone on the fringes from being left out and being susceptible to wolves. And changing in herd structure. One of our more recent depredations, the livestock producers were trying to get larger animals on the landscape, or making sure that calves or smaller calves were held in pastures closer to residential areas. So there's a lot of little tricks that they're looking to utilize to hopefully reduce this conflict.
And Julie, you had something on those too.
Oh, pretty much the same thing, just that there's a lot of husbandry that goes on. The feeding in the evening also does cluster the cattle or sheep, and so that can help a person, even if they need somebody on the landscape to protect them better or, use some sort of night pinning from there. The other thing is carcass removal is really important, and there's, ways to even compost those carcasses and therefore use them back on your ranch, or just to remove them so that there's not attractants on the property for wolves to want to come in and nibble on.
Nibble on, okay. So we're not necessarily talking about carcasses created by the wolves, but I mean any carcass. You just don't want to leave that around. A wolf will take that as an invitation, apparently.
Right, and that's all. Yeah, I mean, and a lot of people used to do a lot of these things, but because we haven't had large predators to deal with, some people have maybe gotten away from some of the more traditional ranching techniques that were used. But I think a lot of them are coming back around if they weren't still using those techniques and using them now.
I wonder if you're hearing things from farmers and ranchers, Julie, that when you say, well, you can try this technique and you'll get this, oh, yeah, my grandfather told me they used to do that sort of response.
A little of it. Some of it, it's not even that removed because they're just good practices. So a lot of them are doing it anyway. I think they just might not always recognize that it would be considered a non-lethal tool, and maybe they need to be a little more quick about doing it so that it gets done before the wolves notice it hasn't been done.
So, Derek, because coyotes hadn't gone away, I mean, I just wonder how different some of these techniques might be to try to keep wolves away from the livestock, from things they had already been doing to keep other species out there.
Yeah, if you've got questions on, coyote behaviors and damage, I would definitely punt that one to Julie. That's really within her wheelhouse.
Okay. So Julie, there's the question. I mean, are these things for wolves so different from the things you would do for coyotes or cougars or any other predator to just to keep them at bay? I mean, these are things it sounds like ranchers have to do already. I mean, how much additional work are they doing for wolves?
Right. In most areas, not much additional work, especially areas like southern Oregon where there aren't that many wolves yet settled there. It's kind of dependent on the density and then and how much those wolves have already gotten into depredation. We kind of seem to have hot spots where there's chronic depredation. I actually think, probably a lot of people that have said wolves for years will laugh at me, but I think wolves are a little easier to manage as far as livestock depredation than coyotes because, like I mentioned at the beginning, they do respond to things and they kind of learn to avoid things. That doesn't mean that they won't keep testing it, but they seem to be a little less persistent at testing it than coyotes. I think the big difference is that management in states of how we manage coyotes versus wolves differs so much, and that's where a lot of the ways that ranchers perceive it as different are coming from because of what they can or can't do when there is a livestock depredation event.
And speaking of perceptions, Julie, I read something you wrote a few years ago about the perceived losses and risks tend to be greater than the actual losses and risks. Is that what you find there?
Yeah, and that was just with some research study again, in that what's reported or remembered is often greater than what happens. Now, that doesn't mean it can't be tragic to an individual producer. I mean, we worked with, you know, a producer, for instance, in Idaho that lost over 100 sheep in one night to wolves. So there can be really big and tragic events, and those are, you know, pretty bad for the person that happens to. But I think a lot of times those are what people remember, and they forget the 5 or 2 or 1, you know, livestock or especially sheep that were killed in the meantime by coyotes that accumulatively might be just as big of an impact on their herd.
All right, so it's a more spectacular thing potentially with wolves,
mm-hmm.
but not that unlike things that have happened before. Derek Broman, before we go, are there things that you work with farmers and ranchers to do before wolves arrive? I mean, have you opened those discussions up so that there are steps that people might take even before they see any wolf evidence?
Certainly, and one of the topics we've already discussed is the removal of attractants and moving of those bone piles, as they call them. That is, you know, a historical activity that was just the norm in livestock practices, where you take all the carcasses are dead and you pile them in one location. But we found out, even with our GPS data on our collared wolves, that those were areas where these animals were readily visiting. And so that activity of removing those bone piles has had quite a strong response. And so livestock producers are pretty well connected. And what's going on in northeastern Oregon is starting to spread throughout the state as far as what they're seeing success with. So we're trying to be as proactive as possible throughout southwest Oregon and elsewhere. So that way, once wolves start to show up in some of these areas, folks are ready to go and at least have a taste or an idea of what they can do to help themselves.
Okay, efforts to make sure that the wolves can be handled before anybody starts pulling out rifles to get rid of them. Derek Broman is with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. He's the Carnivore Fur Bearer Coordinator. Julie Young is with the U.S. Department of Agriculture National Wildlife Research Center. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.